We've been waiting for so long, waiting to play for you some of our songs. We've been waiting for so long, we want to play for you some of our songs.
Bet you by golly gee.
The Central Station is the name of our group. We're making this record especially for you. So lay on back and hear us play and sing, cause we are really gonna.
You are thing, Graham Central Station. Cause we've been waiting for so long, waiting to play for you some of our songs. We've been waiting for so long, we want to play for you some of our songs, cause we've been waiting.
I'd like to thank you all so much for tuning in to WDKK Radio. Once again, my name is D.A. Williams. I'm here with my co-host, Wardell Potts Jr., and we definitely are excited about this evening. We would like to welcome to WDKK tremendous musician, artist, individual who has contributed so much to the American music scene. That is none other than the one and only Mr. Larry Graham. Larry, how are you doing?
Well, can you handle that? All that good stuff you said about me. Wow.
Oh, absolutely. See, that's
thank
one of
you.
My favorite songs, too. Can you handle it? Gotten a lot of trouble because I always tried to
good.
Sing it, and it would never work.
That was the first one to represent Graham Central Station, so that opened the door for us.
Absolutely.
Wow.
Absolutely. And, you know, I am absolutely amazed at your career as a whole. I know both Wardell and myself are drummers. And so, you know, every time we would want to try to find a bass player, you know, we want to find somebody who can thump and pump like Larry Graham.
Well, thank you very much. Yeah, that kind of became the style. If you want to get funky, you got to thump and plug.
Absolutely.
Uh-huh.
Absolutely. Let me ask you a quick question as well. I was looking back through your information and, you know, through your bio, and I found the story to be really interesting about how it came about that you developed that style of playing. Could you tell
uh-huh.
us a little bit about that?
Sure. What happened, when I was growing up, I learned to play various instruments, took piano lessons first, and then the second instrument was drums. I played drums in school in the marching band and the orchestra. I took saxophone. When I was 11, my dad gave me his guitar because he wasn't going to play anymore, and so I taught myself how to play the guitar. So when I was 15, my mother had stopped her world travels because my grandmother had been raising me. But my mother moved back to the mainland. We were living in Oakland, California. And she asked me to join her trio. So we had the Dale Graham Trio with me on guitar and my mother on piano, both of us sang, and my drummer also sang. So that was the trio. And but this one club we worked in had an organ that had the bass foot pedals that I learned to play with my foot at the same time playing the guitar. So now we had bottom.
Okay.
And it sounded full. We got used to that quickly. But then the organ broke down, and now we sounded like we was missing something. So I rented this St. George bass. And the reason I rented it is because my first love was guitar. So as soon as this organ could be fixed, I'm going back to my guitar.
Right.
But as it turned out, the organ couldn't be repaired, so I got stuck on the bass. And then my mother decided that she wanted to go duo, just piano and bass with no drummer. And so now, to make up for not having the kick drum, I would thump the strings. And with my thumb, and to make up for not having that backbeat, I would pluck the strings. So it was kind of like playing drums on the bass, really,
okay.
to make up for not having that beat. And that's how I developed the style, which was later, of course, made famous through the group Sly and the Family Stone with dancing music. Thanks for letting me be myself and others.
Right. Right. That's amazing. That's amazing. And I know that Wardell has a number of questions that he's been waiting to ask you. And just before he does, I do have to say this about your playing style, though, because you made it a little complicated for us drummers as well.
well, you know, what was interesting is that because I hadn't played with a drummer from 15 to like 21
wow.
Years of age, it was really something in my head, like what is that experience going to be like,
right?
You know, playing with a drummer now with Sly and the Family Stone. But Greg Errico is such a great drummer that he just played around what I would play.
Right, right. Mm. Wow. That's interesting. Sly and
yep.
Family Stone. I want to digress for a moment, but Sly and the Family Stone, you all, and I think I mentioned this to you when I spoke with you a few days ago, that I remember times, and this would have had to have been back in the 60s, when you all would come through the Philadelphia area, a Sly knew my father, Kay Williams, pretty well, and you uh-huh. had to come by our record shop. But there was something that about Sly and the Family Stone that it wasn't just that you all were producing good music, but because of a lot of the things that were going on in the country at that time, you all were really a cultural phenomenon. Was that planned, or was it the times? What contributed to that, in your opinion?
The times that we were living in, the 60s was a very interesting time, you know, with the whole scene that was going on in the 60s. That's why Woodstock was such phenomenal success. But we have to give a lot of credit to the writing of Sly.
Okay.
The lyric content of the songs was totally from him. And he also had the genius to recognize that he had some, what some would consider unique individuals in the band that were, you know, playing and contributing some unique things. So he didn't interfere with that. He didn't try to change the way I played the bass, for example, because it was a little strange way to play, you know, back then. And again, I did it out of necessity.
Right.
But it still was a strange way to play. I mean, even some folks would look at me a little sideways because I'm playing incorrectly, you know.
Wow.
He would let me be myself. He would let Freddie be himself. Because nobody played guitar like Freddie.
Right.
So he let him be himself to contribute that. And nobody played drums like Greg Rico.
Right.
You know, he was a very unique drummer. So by letting us be ourselves, it made the music unique for the times. And then the group was self-contained because back during the 50s and 60s, you had groups that were out front singing with a backup band. But our band, we were the band and the singers.
Right.
And trading off different parts, and then you had male and female, you had black and white. So you had all these factors contributing to making the group so unique. But ultimately, the lyric content was coming from Sly, and he was writing about the times that we were living in. So, you know, we have to give him tons of credit on that.
Right.
Sometimes I'm right, but I could be wrong. My own beliefs are in my song. The picture, the figure, the drummer, and then makes no difference what group I'm in.
Everyday people, yeah. Dance in the moonlight, dance at the green, dance for living, dance for living.
That was, of course, I know everybody remembers that tune, Sly and the Family Stone. Once again, you're listening to WDKK Radio. My name is D.A. Williams. I'm here with my co-host, Wardell Potts, and we are talking with the one and only, that's right, the thumper and the plucker, Mr. Larry Graham. That is some hot stuff. Larry, let me ask you a question about Graham Central Station. That concept, because again, it seems like everything that you're involved in tends to be something that's setting a new trend. What developed that concept behind Graham Central Station?
The concept of the way we were set up, the instrumentation and vocals and so forth?
Yes.
That foundation had already been set with Sly and the Family Stone. Graham Central Station just became an extension of that because we, too, had a racially mixed group, male and female, and singing different parts, you know, each person taking different lines of the song. And so that pattern had already been laid out, you know, in Sly and the Family Stone. And so we just was, you know, we just continued on with that. And my writing, of course, was reflecting what was in my heart in the 70s and 80s and from, you know, from then on up until now. And then the pattern that I was following as providing leadership, that had been already set too by my mother, who was a fantastic band leader. And also Sly was a fantastic band leader. So I had good examples, you know, laid out for me. So all I had to do was follow the pattern.
Okay.
You know, and I was guaranteed to go in a positive direction.
Wow. Wow, that's interesting. And this thought comes to my mind because, you know, you mentioned the examples that were set for you. And I know a lot of times now when I ask bass players who their inspirations were, your name is always number one, Larry Graham. Who
were
some of your inspirations musically?
Well, who are my inspirations?
Yes.
Number one would be my mother as a musician. Because if you go back to before I started playing the bass, it was guitar and piano and drums.
Okay.
Go back before the whole incident with the organ, bass pedals, and me renting the bass and all that, and you just got guitar and piano and drums. So when my mother would solo, I would play bass patterns on my guitar sometimes, and when I would solo on the guitar, she would play bass patterns on the piano.
Wow.
And so some of the bass patterns that was going into my brain and heart was really coming from my mother's left hand, a great deal of when I switched over to bass, those kinds of bass patterns, some of them came from her playing because she was influencing me with bass patterns before I even started playing the bass. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
Just won't hide.
created a way of playing. Nobody was doing it. You know, I mean, that's an amazing thing. And I think that's why it's such an honor, you know, to have you on the broadcast, because one of the things we definitely like to do is to really highlight and feature the musicians who put so much of their life, their soul, their spirit into music, and it has lasted through time. And you are definitely way up there on that list. And so, again, I thank you for taking out your time to come and share with us on WDKK.
Well, thank you very much for having me. And that whole thing that you just said, I mean, the story turned out well. It could have went the other way, because I could have just been playing nightclubs as this weird bass player that nobody would want to hire,
right?
Because the way he plays is so abstract. But because of the success of, you know, songs like Dance to the Music and I Want to Take You Higher, Everyday People, you know, all those songs that the bass part, you know, was kind of prominent, that drew attention to what I was doing. And if you were going to copy our songs, a couple of our songs, you had to play, I mean, you can only play Thank You for Let Me Be Myself if you thump and pluck.
So you had to
copy my style, and then bass players start incorporating that style into songs that they were writing, and so now we have what we have today. But I have to really just, you know, give a lot of credit to my mother and to Sly and the Family Stone, and for the success of Grand Central Station, and even my solo career starting with One in a Million, because my mother had me sing in Dallas early on. So I've had a lot of people to contribute to what I am today.
That's great. That is great. Wardell?
Well, yeah, you know, I just have to say you're such a humbling. I mean, just listening to you, knowing your career, I mean, you're such an incredible talent, and you're so humble about it. It just makes me, like, in awe. I mean, I really, really enjoyed you as a musician. Me being a musician, but there was a song that you did that was so aggressive, which most of your stuff with Grand Central Station was very aggressive. But there's one particular song, you know, from a songwriter's point of view, really took me back when I heard this song. And the song is called Hair. And the way that you played that bass and then come up with these lyrics and melody to fit in there. Can you tell me something about that concept of that song, the lyrically? What did that Hair song mean to you? And it was so aggressive. As a writer, how were you able to get those melodies in there so cleverly? It was so clever.
Thank you. Well, the subject matter is pretty obvious. You know, those of us who had a big afro, we were very proud of it. And, you know, we would spend a lot of time in the mirror picking that bad boy out. So it's just so just right. And it was something to be proud of. And hair became a topic and an issue for not only black folks, but folks with straight hair. Of course, having long hair hanging down your back. Either way, it was an issue, and it, you know, really kind of stood for what you were about. And for me, I had exceptionally long hair with huge afro, and then Tina, who was a flight attendant, would on her off time. This is before I met her. She would braid selected people's hair. As kind of a hobby and kind of like a little side income when she was not flying as a flight attendant. So I heard about her and went over, and she did my hair, and it would take about 8 hours. It just made my hair grow even more. So then it got like really, really long, and it became like a really, really big issue. And people would ask me everywhere, is that really all your hair?
Now, see, for some of you younger people, I have to do this. For some of you younger people who don't know what Wardell's talking about, you can't understand what Larry Graham's talking about, I have to let you hear it. Here it is, Hair. We'll be right back.
Of his hair.
Now, see, nobody could play that. I knew a lot of bass players, Larry, and no one played that bass pattern. Absolutely. Now, there's something else no one else could do. Because when you started doing some of your solo stuff with your albums, and, I mean, it just blew me away as well. I got in a lot of trouble with a lot of ladies because there was this one song that you did, and every time it would come on and I hit the dance floor, instead of just dancing, I would try to sing it to the ladies as well, and they would get upset. So for all of our female listeners, could you just give us just a little sample of One in a Million You?
Love had played his games on me so long, I started to believe I'd never find anyone. Thou to try to convince me to give in, said you can't win.
See, that's the one that got me in trouble. that was it. Now, when you started doing that phase of your career, because it was slightly different from some of the earlier work that you had done, but was that, you know, really something that was in you that creatively you just needed to get out and you felt that was the right time to do it because it worked?
Well, I was doing ballads and stuff before the funk.
Right. Okay.
You know, when I was working with my mother, she had me singing all those songs that were made popular by male singers at the time, like I mentioned, Billy Eckstine, Nat Cole, and others. So I was into singing ballads before the funk.
Okay.
So I was really going back to my roots when I did One in a Million, and it was a departure from what I was doing with Graham Central Station, and so the record company was not feeling it at all. They didn't really want me to come with that as a single. They wanted me to come with something else funky.
Okay.
Because I guess they were afraid they would, you know, it would hurt record sales, I would lose part of my audience, and so, but in my contract, fortunately, I had a clause in there which allowed me to make the final choice for the single that would come from the album.
Mm-hmm.
And so I forced the issue. I put it out anyway. And then when it started having success, and of course, then the record company started supporting it because they realized that, okay, well, this is an extended market, you know, for Graham. And so it turned out well. But yeah, that was going back to my roots.
Love had played his games on me so long, I started to believe I'd never find anyone. Doubt had tried to convince me to give in, said you can't win. But one day the sun came shining through, the rain had stopped and the skies were blue, and oh, what a revelation to see, someone was saying I love you to me. On one in a million chance of a lifetime, life showed compassion and sent to me a stroke of love called you. A one in a million you. I was a lonely man with empty arms to fill. Then I found a piece of happiness to call my own. And life is worth living again. For to love you to me is to live. Oh, one in a million chance of a lifetime.
Let me ask you a question on that same note for young artists today. Who are getting involved with the music industry, what type of advice would you give them from the creative aspect? Like you mentioned, the record company didn't want you to do it, but you made the decision. It worked out. What type of advice would you give the young artist along those lines?
Well, don't get ripped off like we did. We'll start there.
Okay.
Because the amount of money per album or single that the record companies would give the artists was ridiculously low, totally unfair. And so a lot of artists like myself and tons of others, you don't really make that much money. Most of it goes to the record company. That's one thing. So watch out for that. The other thing is all those songs that I recorded, you know, I don't own the masters to those. The record company owns the masters. So it's not my grandkids and kids that's going to benefit from that as much as, you know, their grandkids and kids. You know, that stuff get passed on to, you know, their people. So that's another thing. If you can possibly work out a situation where, you know, you own your masters, or at least in a designated period of time they come back to you,
right?
Then I would highly recommend that you have your attorney structure the deal in that way. I also think it's important to have, you know, an attorney that you trust. Try to find somebody who's honest, maybe recommended by some folks who had success using that attorney, and have them help you to structure the deal so that, you know, they don't slip some language in there on you that will rob you, because they're trained they went to school to learn how to put things in certain ways to make it mean certain things to their benefit.
Okay.
We weren't trained. While we're learning how to play music, they're learning how to write stuff down in a way to, you know, make it an advantage for them and their record company or whoever they represent. So try to find a lawyer, and you can find them. They're out there. But if they are recommended by someone that you trust, that's something to go on. So those things I would recommend. Also, you know, try to use your gift in a positive way. A lot of us have been gifted with the ability to play music, and music is such a powerful tool. You know, it can make you laugh, it can make you cry, it can make you happy, it can make you sad, it can make you fight, you know, it can make you feel love in your heart. There's a lot of things that, emotions that music can stir up.
Right.
Use it in a positive way. It's a gift from God. Use it the way He intended it. We don't want to talk about negative things that will only cause harm, and we want to use it in a way that will make people happy. So, like when people come to my show, like now what's happening a whole lot is a lot of parents are bringing their children to shows. If you look online, like when we just played a number of shows, you see online, sometimes when I have people come up on the stage, they bring kids are up there, and in the audience there's tons of kids. That, first of all, they know the music is going to be positive. We're not going to be singing about crazy stuff and negative stuff.
Right.
So they know that they're safe like that. Plus, they're proud to bring their kids to a show to see real musicians playing real music, live music. We're playing
Amen.
Our instruments. You know, we're not pushing a button and everything is already pre-done. We're not playing to a pre-recorded track.
Right.
Music. If I make a sharp left turn real quick in the middle of the show, my band is right there.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have to just stick to what's being played on this tape. So I can respond to the audience, you know, and depending on how they was, I can extend the song. I can make a segue into another one. I can make it faster, slower. I can do whatever I want because it's live.
Right.
And so that's important, too. And, you know, parents bring their kids, say, hey, this is the stuff that I grew up on. This is what you want to listen to, especially if you want to play, too.
Right.
And encourage the kids to learn how to play. Using modern technology is cool. You know, it's okay if you want to use sequencers and machines and so forth. I'm not against that. But learn how to play your instrument as well. And use the machines. Don't let them use and control you.
Oh, that's great.
This is wonderful because I just want to say, man, that you the stuff that you played on the bass was so incredible, but that I think that your drummer did an incredible job of doing just that. He made it so that whatever you played, there was no conflict. It was, and I listened to some of the stuff from Grand Central Station over and over and over, and I go, this guy really was doing it well. And I mean, to produce that kind of stuff, that's what I wanted to ask you. You produced the project as well, right?
Yeah, my first production. Well, the first thing that I wanted to do after I left Sly and the Family Stone was I didn't have any intentions of starting my own group. I wanted to produce and write for someone else. So I put this group together called Hot Chocolate, which is not the Hot Chocolate that later on had a hit record out. But this group was built around Patrice Chocolate Banks. And so that's, you know, the intention was to write for them. So I recorded some stuff and was doing some gigs around the Bay Area they were. But they were playing at this club called Bimbo's in San Francisco one night. And it was getting toward the end of the show, and people in the audience had spotted me, and everybody started, you know, urging me to go up on the stage and hit this last tune with them. And I did. And it was like a natural thing that happened. It was like obvious that night their bass player lost his job. And, you know, I was a natural fit because I knew their stuff well. I'd written most of it, and other than the cover tunes. And so we just clicked, and I just changed the name to Graham Central Station, and that was the beginning.
Wow.
Some of the songs that I had written for them is on the first album, the first GCS, the one that's called Graham Central Station, and then the rest I wrote after.
Mm-hmm. Okay. When did you realize that your voice, because, I mean, your voice is an incredible instrument in itself. When did you realize that you had that? Was that back when you were Sly that you realized that, or when you were younger? Or did you, because on Grand Central Station, it seems that's when you really started just throwing it out there to it.
Well, what happened was when I was working with my mother, when you're playing clubs and lounges and stuff, you got your basic salary, but you make a lot in tips. Because you have, like, we call the kitty that you put on top of the piano, like a little glass or something where people can put money in it when they make a request if you know the song. So we made it a point to know everything. My mother had this thick, thick music book. They call it the fake book, that you have your lyrics and your basic chord structure and the melody and stuff. So anyway, somebody would come up and make a request. If we knew it, they put money in there. So I knew I had to sing all of the male vocalists who were popular at the time, Nat Cole, Billy Eckstein, Frank Sinatra, Tony Bennett, or whoever. My mother covered all the female vocalists, the Dinah Washingtons and so on. So I was singing ballads and stuff then, because by 15, my voice had already changed over, because I never went through that thing that boys go through where you got that little funny thing happens with your voice. Where your voice cracks and stuff when it's getting ready to change. Mine just went straight from singing Frankie Lyman's Why Do Fools Fall in Love, because I had a high voice, to just, you know, baritone and bass. It started with my mother doing ballads. So on the first Sly and the Family Stone record, A Whole New Thing, the first album, one of the feature songs that I'm on is Let Me Hear It From You, which is a ballad.
And for those who want to know more about, because Larry did mention the photos online, he has a fantastic website. I want to give you that web address just before Wardell continues this conversation. And you can find Larry Graham's website at www.larrygraham, that's LarryGraham.com. Again, that's www.larrygraham.com. You can find out more about what he's doing. You'll see his itinerary. He has a great store on there where you can get just all kind of stuff, hats and T-shirts and keychains and whatever you want. But just go out to, again, www.larrygraham.com. That's the website. He has tremendous music there, just anything that you want. So I do want to encourage the listeners to go out and shop around.
Yikes, that was great. You just blew me up there. That was wonderful. I was going to mention something about it. I'm glad I didn't. I couldn't have laid it out like that. Thank you.
Larry, with everything that you've done,
made me want to go type in on my computer and look at it again.
Yes, indeed. You deserve everything that anyone can do for you, because, I mean, you are so instrumental and iconic in American music that, you know, my words can't express it all. I'm so appreciative. And absolutely. Wardell, what you have, my brother?
I just wanted to go back to what Larry was saying in regards to the sequencing and stuff like that. There, you know, Larry, a lot of the musicians, you know, because it hurts me to this day knowing how wonderful it was to become a musician. You know, just that camaraderie of all your buddies. You're learning how to play. You're enjoying this. And, you know, we don't see the school supporting teaching these kids how to play instruments anymore. You hardly see them walk down the street with their instruments. You know, and back in the day, I remember he used to say, wow, he got his horn, and you see people walking down there with these big instruments bigger than them, you know. And nowadays, it's gone. And with these sequencers, these kids do not actually get a chance to pick an instrument that they feel passionate about, because they get stuck on the computer. And that just kills me.
Yeah, and see, that's what parents kick in, and that's why I always encourage parents. You know, there's some things that school is not going to teach kids, some things that you may want your kid to learn about a lot of things. You might have things about God that you want them to learn from what's in the Bible. Very, very important. Maybe there are some issues that you really want to address from the standpoint of what does God think about it. Well, maybe they're not going to learn that in school, but as a parent, you have the responsibility to teach them that and other things that they, you know, might not learn in school. And music is becoming, like you mentioned, another one, because a lot of the schools are cutting out some of the music programs. They're not providing instruments and so forth. But I'll never forget when I got my first solid body electric guitar. I went downtown to get my grandmother's coffee like I did once a week. And I'd take the bus down, get the coffee, and take the bus back. And I was walking back to the bus stop. I'd gotten her coffee, and I looked in this music store window, and there was a white Supro electric solid body guitar with gold knobs.
Mm. Mm.
Forget the bus. I ran all the way home and told my grandmother. I called her Mommy M. And I'm, Mommy M, you got to come see this guitar. I just was going a zillion miles an hour. And we didn't have much money at all. We was living in the hood. But my grandmother sacrificed, and I can appreciate later as an adult how much she sacrificed. She took the money, went down to Minicetti's Music in Oakland, got that guitar for me, and that really launched my whole career. That started my life. But she had to buy it. The school didn't give it to me.
Mm-hmm.
She bought it for me. And so if, as parents, we have to, if we can, some kind of way, make a sacrifice. It doesn't have to be a new instrument. It might come from a used place, a pawn shop or something. One famous person I know found his at a gas station. Until this day, he still plays. It was a cheap guitar, but it was, you know, it got the job done. So as a parent, we might have to make a sacrifice to get that instrument, but some kind of way, if we can, get it encourage your child to learn to play it. My grandmother, who was raising me when I was growing up, encouraged me every day. Some days I didn't want to practice, but she encouraged me in a kind, loving way, and I kept to it, and then once I learned how to play, then it became a joy. But we need encouragement. You know, I needed encouragement with piano. I needed encouragement from my coach to run track. I didn't want to hit my knees on them hurdles.
Right.
But through encouragement, you know, I did it. So get your child the instrument that they choose and encourage them to learn how to play it.
That's very great. That's very great advice. And parents, mm-hmm. you heard it right from Larry Graham himself. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. We'll be right back.
nice. All you have to do is just listen to my warmth. Then you will know why they call me